You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, jujitsu means the gentle art in Japanese. An Appleton police lieutenant tells us why officers are learning the sport and how it could change their department. Now, antiviral pills to treat the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 have been called a game changer. But the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that some pharmacies in Wisconsin aren't seeing a lot of demand for them. We're taking a look at the medications, how they work, and why they're not always getting to the patients who could benefit from them. Dr. Bart Capone treats hospitalized patients at UW Health. He's a clinical professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Capone, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about these antiviral pills and how they work against COVID-19?
Absolutely. The first antiviral pill is called molnupiravir, and that causes lethal mutagenesis, or a series of mutations in the virus RNA that ultimately leads to it not being able to reproduce or do the things it needs to do. The other pill is a combination of two antivirals. The brand name is Paxlovid, and that blocks a chemical in the virus called viral protease. And without that, once again, the virus can't reproduce.
What's the deal with timing on these? When do we take them in the course of a COVID-19 infection?
Great question, and that's one of the important barriers. Mm-hmm. People need to start these therapies within 5 days of the onset of their symptoms. So the window's pretty tight compared to some of the monoclonal antibodies where you have as much as 10 days from symptom onset to get in and get treated.
Yeah, can you talk about that? If I have like maybe symptoms today, I get tested in a couple days, takes a couple days to get the test back. By the time I have that lockdown, it might be too late for these pills to be of benefit?
Yes, absolutely.
They've been described as a game changer by some people, if we can get them used and get them used right. Why? How big a difference can they make?
They certainly can make a difference, and it's nice to have a potentially effective treatment for COVID. But to call it a game changer is a little challenging. For Paxlovid, if we look at the published data, which looked at unvaccinated patients at the highest risk of getting very sick from COVID, we had to treat 17 to 20 patients to save one hospitalization or emergency room visit. If you look at molnupiravir, that number is more like 35. For comparison, based on some old studies, for people who have strep throat and get penicillin, the number needed to treat there is about 3.5. So not quite as powerful as some other treatments for some other diseases.
So weighing that maybe, I guess, more limited effect versus possible side effects, is this something that people should be seeking out if they get a COVID-19 positive diagnosis?
I think on balance, yes. From our perspective, the biggest benefit is saving any hospital beds. You know, everyone's aware of how strapped healthcare has been for a long period of time, and in particularly in the last Omicron surge. Our perspective was that getting these pills to the people at the highest risk of getting sick to prevent them from getting sicker and or requiring a hospital bed is a winner. In terms of side effects, so far these medications seem pretty well tolerated. It hasn't been out in large quantities for a very long time, so it's a little hard to say yet.
So with all that in mind, Dr. Capone, what do you think it would take to overcome some of the barriers and get these drugs into wider use?
Primarily supply. That was maybe the single biggest barrier for the 17,000-odd patients UW Health considers medically homed with us. We've received around 200 courses of therapy. That's a very approximate estimate, but it's close. DHS and the federal government successfully allocated these to the states, trying to share for everyone. So supply is the major choke point right now. That 5-day window for symptoms is a big challenge, and especially as people are increasingly vaccinated and taking precautions. And if they're not high risk, you know, is that stuffy nose a symptom of COVID, or is it just something you hope will go away? And then when there's testing delays, as you alluded to earlier, all of a sudden we've run out of our 5 days and we can't get them to people. So it's a very multifaceted problem to get these out faster.
That Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece I referenced earlier, they went to pharmacies and said, you know, the pharmacist said, we're just not seeing a lot of prescriptions coming our ways. We've got the supply here, but nobody's coming in to get them. Do the drugs need to be in a different place in the first place?
Perhaps, you know, the challenge there is that pharmacies is how we generally distribute drugs. Mm-hmm. Speaking for my team, we have a large and very skilled and professional pharmacy department. And we'd been thinking about this for a long period of time. Anecdotally, I've heard of smaller pharmacies like privately owned, like quote, mom and pop, end quote, operations where they suddenly get this allocation of pills and they're not sure what to do with it. How do you advertise this? And it's not as simple as just passing it out. Paxlovid, for example, has many potential drug interactions that need to be checked carefully before you distribute the pill. So that's another logistical challenge.
I'm guessing I know your answer to this, but these aren't a replacement. These pills aren't a replacement for getting vaccinated. Is that right?
I agree with that. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
So how do you see these antiviral pills being used as we start now this effectively third year of the pandemic?
They're another useful tool in the toolbox. Again, we don't know what the long-term outlook for these medications are, and I'm no virologist, but molnupiravir does have a potential to induce resistance by changing how it induces the mutations. Paxlovid is pretty well preserved across coronaviruses, and a lot of the research on that comes from the original SARS virus, but we won't know until we get there, basically.
Dr. Capone, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Bart Capone. He treats hospitalized patients at UW Health and teaches medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us today to talk about new antiviral pills that treat COVID-19 and why they're not being widely used in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. This story touches on racism and violence.
In 1930, three black teenagers were accused of murder in Indiana. After their arrest, an angry mob dragged two of the young men out of the jail and lynched them next to the courthouse. Then they came for the third boy, 16-year-old James Cameron. Here he is telling his story on WHYY's Fresh Air.
And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron." And as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. They got me up to the tree, and someone said, "Where's the rope?" They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, "Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins." I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, "Take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing."
Miraculously, the crowd let him go. Dr. James Cameron is supposedly the only person to survive a lynching in the United States. Cameron dedicated his life to sharing his story, the civil rights movement, and eventually landed in Milwaukee, where he founded America's Black Holocaust Museum. The museum's head griot, Reggie Jackson, says Cameron was moved after a trip to a Holocaust memorial in Israel with his wife.
And while they were standing there, they were both in tears, and he turned to his wife, Virginia, and he said, "Virginia, we need a museum like this in America to tell what happened to black people and all of those freedom-loving whites that have been with us along this journey."
He didn't start the museum until he was 74 years old.
That's America's Black Holocaust Museum virtual curator, Fran Kaplan.
He bought a boxing gym for a dollar. He had been collecting for years artifacts that people would send him. Things like Ku Klux Klan outfits that they found in their attics in Milwaukee.
People from around the world came to this small museum in Milwaukee to hear the stories that Dr. Cameron shared. It became really something very unique because it was a telling of American history from a different perspective than a majority of us have ever had.
The museum's doors stayed open in the Bronzeville neighborhood for 20 years. It closed after Cameron passed away in 2006 at age 92.
So we have this exhibit which talks about life in Africa.
The museum has been resurrected. It's housed in a new physical building, but its doors are not open yet. Organizers continue to raise money to finish the displays and create an endowment. Jackson gives me a tour of some of the displays featuring African empires, slavery, and the Jim Crow era.
And as you kind of get further into the museum, probably the most emotional part of the former museum was our simulated slaving ship.
Dr. Cameron's legacy lives on in this new museum.
He said on many, many occasions that the museum is designed to help people. It's not designed to hurt anybody. It's not designed to make people feel uncomfortable. This is as American as any other part of our history.
People are looking to change what's happening in race relations in this country. And Dr. Cameron was way out ahead of this. He emphasized that the truth would set you free.
This man who survived a lynching at the age of 16, who was forced to witness a lynching at the age of 8, found a way to not be a hateful person, found a way to take tragic events that happened in his life and use that experience, those emotions, to grow into a person who wanted to make the world better for everybody.
Go to our website, wisconsinlife.org, where you can learn so much more about Dr. James Cameron's life and the eventual reopening of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jiu-jitsu is a grappling-based martial art from Japan. The sport was popularized in Brazil. Now it's making its way to Wisconsin. Our guest today is bringing jiu-jitsu to his police department, where he hopes it could help officers improve their confidence and lead to less violent arrests. Lieutenant Bill Krieg is the professional development coordinator for the Appleton Police Department. He's been practicing jiu-jitsu since 1997 and is a second-degree black belt. Lieutenant Krieg, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
First, for people not familiar with jiu-jitsu and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, can you describe it and how it's different from other forms of martial art that people might be familiar with?
Yeah, well, it's primarily a ground-based martial art that emphasizes more on the leverage and controlling of a person rather than punching and kicking. So it would equate more to like a high school wrestling than like a boxing match if you were to watch it, being practiced.
And how did you first arrive at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
When I went to college at UW Milwaukee, I decided I wanted to try some martial arts. I tried some karate, I tried some taekwondo, and my body type just didn't quite work for me for trying to kick above my head. When I found out I could actually grab onto somebody and wrestle with somebody, use my body and my leverage to my advantage, I was hooked. So, and it kind of comes into play with early UFCs, like in the early 1990s, as the mixed martial arts scene started picking up, jiu-jitsu became more and more prevalent in the martial art world.
And now you are part of, I think, a movement around the country where some departments are looking at the idea of jiu-jitsu training for officers. Can you talk about what that can mean for police officers on the job?
Well, there's a number of different movements. You know, as you mentioned, there's different groups trying to push jiu-jitsu into law enforcement training. The goal is really to make officers less tool dependent, reduce some of their fear and anxiety when on the street, reduce some of the severity of how force is used, and ultimately reducing injury to both the officers and the subjects, because you're removing a lot of the striking needs or the need for a baton or pepper spray. And again, just kind of wrestling them into control versus having to strike them.
Can you talk through some of the training that you might work with your fellow officers on?
Sure. Well, whenever you're sparring, sparring is when two people are practicing jiu-jitsu together, you're constantly dealing with their body weight, their pressure, the sense of feel. And so it almost becomes kind of an ongoing scenario. Like, what if the person grabs me this way, or what if they try to pull away that way? And you're always adjusting to their movements and to the dynamics of the situation. So a lot of our scenario training that we do at the department carries right into the physical training that we do when we're trying to take somebody into custody.
I've seen some people make the case that this kind of training, as you mentioned, will help build confidence for officers and maybe make them confident enough to de-escalate without even using jiu-jitsu. Is that one of your hopes in this training?
Completely. The idea of de-escalation, it's so important in policing. But for me to de-escalate somebody, I have to go in there calm myself. And if I'm anxious, if I'm nervous, if I'm afraid to get too close to somebody, that can make it difficult for me to de-escalate somebody else when I myself am not able to control my own emotions. So the confidence that comes from understanding jiu-jitsu, understanding, you know, the complexities of interacting with somebody physically, allows me to get closer to somebody while not feeling like I'm in more danger.
I've seen some people raise concern. There was a national article about this saying, you know, maybe having a martial art in an officer's toolkit might make them more prone to a physical confrontation using these tools instead of a non-contact de-escalation technique. What would you say to someone who had that concern?
I kind of equate jiu-jitsu to like a physical de-escalation, because as I'm talking with somebody and I'm verbally de-escalating, I'm verbally talking with them, that's the ideal. If I can persuade them to cooperate and everything goes smooth that way, that is definitely the ideal. If I do have to go hands-on, though, I would rather physically manipulate them in a way that they're not going to get hurt, that I'm not going to get hurt. And if I have to rely on tools because I don't know jiu-jitsu, I have to use my baton, I have to use my taser, there's a higher likelihood of somebody getting hurt. So the idea of training officers to do jiu-jitsu more, while they'd be more confident to go to jiu-jitsu, they would also have more ability to talk without feeling the need to change to a higher level of force than what jiu-jitsu may bring to the table.
We're talking to Lieutenant Bill Krieg from the Appleton Police Department, a professional development coordinator there. He's a second-degree black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, talking about the value of training officers in jiu-jitsu. Lieutenant Krieg, is this something that you're seeing lots of departments around the country, even the state, do, or do you see yourself kind of on the cutting edge here?
I would say we're still kind of on the cutting edge. It's definitely becoming more common. The state itself has what we call our state model. There are state-approved techniques. And a handful of years ago, they incorporated a few of the ground-based movements that you would see in jiu-jitsu into the state model. A very small amount, but it's the beginning. But a lot of police departments are in areas where there aren't qualified jiu-jitsu instructors. So to reach those officers is becoming more difficult, or had been difficult. It's becoming easier with online training, with the, you know, with YouTube and various websites, so they can be exposed to it. But finding those qualified instructors that understand the difference between a sport jiu-jitsu versus a street effective jiu-jitsu can be very difficult. We're fortunate in Appleton that we have a number of highly qualified jiu-jitsu practitioners. Milwaukee, Madison, some of the bigger communities, Green Bay, they have very qualified instructors. But you get to some parts of the state and they struggle to find people that can help them.
I know this is new enough that there's probably not a lot of data about how effective this has been. What are you hoping to see when it comes to collecting information about what happens when a department like yours trains officers in jiu-jitsu?
Well, it's funny because during COVID, I did an audit of our use of force numbers for 10 years prior. So I actually have data from 2010 to 2019. I started at Appleton in 2009. So with my jiu-jitsu influence kind of coming into play, we've actually kind of seen it play out in our use of force numbers. For example, in 2010 to 2019, that 10-year span, we used force on 598 individuals, and 85% of them required zero medical treatment, and we had no baton strikes, no OC spray, and only 14% were actually struck with a form of a hand strike. So we've actually seen those numbers come down or continuing to try to lower the numbers to this day.
A caller's raising a concern. I don't have time to bring him on the air, but a concern about chokeholds. Of course, a lot of attention after the death of George Floyd. Are chokeholds something that would come up in this kind of jiu-jitsu?
Chokeholds are a part of the sport aspect of jiu-jitsu. So if I were training in my gi at a tournament or in a school, there would be chokeholds being applied within the practice environment. Now, from the police standpoint, our policy prohibits chokeholds. So if you look in our Appleton use of force policy, chokeholds are prohibited. We still practice it as part of the sport outside of the PD, but inside the walls of the PD, we don't practice chokeholds.
And if I could take just a minute or two, can you talk about the sport side? This isn't just work for you. Can you talk about what you've gotten out of jiu-jitsu in your life since you started, as you said, back at UW-Milwaukee?
Yeah, well, it really becomes kind of a family. And like any hobby, you really kind of get immersed into the culture of whatever your hobby is. For me, it happened to be jiu-jitsu. So the ways to stay in shape, the ways to form friendships, you know, as I travel all over the country, I can visit different jiu-jitsu schools, meet different people. And then there's a subculture of people that train jiu-jitsu that are also cops or in law enforcement. And you instantly have a bond with somebody. And there's a really nice friendship that's there just from knowing that they're also a practitioner of jiu-jitsu.
Lieutenant Krieg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
That's Lieutenant Bill Krieg, the Professional Development Coordinator for the Appleton Police Department, also a second-degree black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We talked about Lieutenant Krieg's effort to bring the martial art to his police department and his hopes that it could change the way officers handle potentially violent situations. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest news from Russia and Ukraine. As Russian troops occupy new parts of the country, the U.S. and Europe respond with sanctions. We'll look at the latest changes, the latest actions from Russia, from the U.S., Western Europe, and Ukraine itself. And of course, you could join in with your thoughts and your questions. And we'll look at one of your questions from our Why Sconsin project. What happens to farms and to farmers after they close down operations? We're going to hear from a former farm crisis counselor, and we want to hear your stories. Still time for you to actually share your story if you've been through a farm closure. Maybe the farm you grew up in, a farm you ran for years, you had to close operations or sell off part of the land. We want to hear your story. You can share it right now. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. And a big thank you to everybody who gave during our winter member drive this year. A great response. Always just humbled and floored by your love of Wisconsin Public Radio, your willingness to pay for it. If you were out of town and missed the whole thing, you could still give over at wpr.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a sponsor of a proposal for paid family leave here in Wisconsin and look at the labor impact of parental leave policies on a national scale. First, Major League Baseball is in a lockout with its Players Association, but that isn't stopping us from talking about Milwaukee Brewers baseball. The lockout comes as Milwaukee Journal Sentinel beat reporter Tom Haudricourt plans to retire at the beginning of March. He's leaving the gig after covering the Brewers for over 35 years, so we wanted to have him on to get his best stories and memories from a long and decorated career. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a devoted Brewers fan for the last few decades? Do you have a high or low point to share? Do you have questions for Tom about the Brewers over that span of history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Tom Haudricourt is a Milwaukee Brewers beat reporter for another week or two for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, congratulations on retirement and welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. It's hard to get my brain wrapped around the end of 36 years covering the Brewers, but it's coming up fast now.
Well, I guess Major League Baseball is having the same problem. Looks like they don't want to go on without you.
Yeah, somebody told me that, you know, the baseball's protesting my retirement by locking up. I am not going to suggest that that has anything to do with it. I don't think they really know or care that I'm retiring. But it is odd, though, isn't it? I mean, because we had had 26 years of labor peace. We had not had any type of labor stoppage since 1995, 94, 95. I'm sure people remember that disastrous strike that led to the cancellation of the 94 World Series. And so then we had gone into a long period of labor peace. And I think the game was better for it. Everybody was better for it. And, you know, if you're a young fan, like in your 20s, you have never experienced this before. And you're probably wondering what the heck's going on here.
Now, you were from Virginia originally. You came to Milwaukee. Did you know you're coming in for the long haul?
I did not. You know, when I was offered the Brewers beat at the old Milwaukee Sentinel, remember that there used to be two newspapers in Milwaukee, the Sentinel, the morning paper, and then the Journal, the evening paper. When I came here in 1985, actually during the season, the Sentinel lost their beat writer during the season and needed a replacement. And they contacted me and I came and, No, it's there was a brief period in 2002 and 3 when I was in New York and I covered the Yankees for the Bergen Record. But that was because my wife was offered a job there that ended up closing down after 9/11. And so we ended up coming back. So we did have that brief little interlude. But no, it's this has been, Milwaukee's been my home for most of my adult life and almost all of my married life. And so we're going to move back to Virginia now, where both Trish and I are from. And hopefully we'll still like it. It's been a long time since we've lived there.
Now, our producer went digging back through the archives of the old Milwaukee Sentinel. The oldest Tom Hodrycourt byline he could find was September 16th of 1985. You wrote up a game recap, a complete game for Milwaukee. Milwaukee's pitcher, the Brewers, lost 4-2 to the Red Sox. I was going to do it as a quiz. I don't want to drop that on you. Jeff, the legendary Jeff Sellers beat us, who pitched 4 years in the majors. Do you? What's your memory of your first complete game covering the Brewers?
Well, that would have been like about a month into my stint with the Sentinel, because I started like in mid-August. Well, I'll just tell you this. I do. When I started covering the Brewers for the Sentinel in 85, the Journal's beat writer was a man named Tom Flaherty, who had been there for some time and was there still for some time after that. I mean, we became very good friends. But I do remember in 1985, after watching that team for about a week, turning to Tom Flaherty in the press box and said, this team was really in the World Series 3 years ago? What happened? You know, because by 85, they were in disarray, you know, total disarray. A lot of the players had gotten old, injured. You know, people thought that might be a dynasty type team. And they did. The 86 Brewers were in first place until like September. And then they fell apart. And Harvey Keene was actually fired, the manager, at the end of that year, the manager that led him to the World Series the year before. So that was probably a very good indication of the old adage, what have you done for me lately? And baseball certainly is true on that account. But, it was some tough times there for some of the 80s. But I'll tell you one thing, though. One of my favorite years I've ever covered them was just 2 years later, 1987, the team that became known as Team Streak. They started 13-0, which was a record. Juan Nieves was pitching no-hitter. Rob Deere had that famous Easter Sunday home run. And then Paul Molitor later in the year had a 39-game hitting streak. That team did not go to the postseason, Rob. If they had the wild card back then, they might have. I'd have to check. But for a non-playoff team, it was about as thrilling a ride as you could have, a real roller coaster. They won their first 13 games, and not long after that, they lost 12 in a row. And it's not easy to win 13 in a row and lose 12 in a row all in the same season, much less the same, you know, first couple of months. So that was a crazy ride, but man, that was a fun team to cover.
Well, we've got Bob Uecker's call of that very Easter Sunday 1987 game you were just talking about, calling a game tying and then a game winning, spoiler alert, home run.
Here's the pitch. A curveball! Drilled to deep left! Could it get way, way, way out of here and gone for dear! And they have tied it at four! Whoa, whoa! 3-2, two outs, 4-4, ninth inning. Gantner, there he goes, the pitch, a swing and a fly ball, right field and deep. Get up and get out of here! Gone for Swain! Two-run blast by Swaim to win it. Oh, my goodness. Holy cow. Do you believe it?
All right, Tom. Now, the careful listener will note that Bob Uecker shows subtle signs of excitement at some points in a game. What's it like for you and your colleagues in the press box? Are you freaking out at moments like this, or are you just kind of nodding along, I don't know, chomping your cigar? I don't know what's going on in there.
Well, let me tell you, Rob, let me tell you a funny story about that moment that Deer hit that home run. So that was back before cell phones, right? We didn't have personal phones back in 1987. So we had just a desk phone on the counter in the press box. The Sentinel had its own line, telephone line there. And so right as Deer steps to the plate, that phone rings. And I say to myself, who in the heck is calling at this point of the game? You know, and so I answer the phone. It's my wife, Trish, and she calls, and I don't know where she was. She obviously was not home watching it. She must have been away from home, but she said, what's going on? Are they going to win? Are they going to win their 12th round? And I said, no, Trish, they're going to lose. They're losing by 3 runs here in the ninth inning. And no sooner did that come out of my mouth than Deer hit that home run. And I hung up on my wife without telling her what happened.
We're talking to Tom Hodricourt, the still married Tom Hodricourt, I understand, a Milwaukee Brewers beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, retiring at the beginning of next month after 3+ decades. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for Tom about the Brewers, their history, his reporting. 800-642-1234 is the number. Okay, some high points there in 85 and 87, Tom. And then, what was it like to be a Brewers reporter in, I don't know, an extended drought?
Yeah, and the 90s were not kind to the Brewers. It was, you know, besides the strike, and, you know, they were having a fight over the stadium too. And, you know, in 92, Phil Garner's first year, they won like 92 games, I believe. And they had, that was a crazy running team. They stole a whole bunch of bases. Phil Garner brought like a National League style to the American League. And the Brewers just ran teams crazy, set a record for stolen bases. And the Pat Listecher was rookie of the year and stole like 54 bases. But then after that, man, the team went into the deep, dark wilderness. And there was 12 consecutive losing seasons after that. And 14 consecutive seasons without a winning record. There was one 500 record in there. And then they finally, you know, they finally broke through in 2008. I'll give you a little spoiler alert. I've written a column on my 10 most favorite seasons to cover of the 36 I've covered with the Brewers for the Journal Sentinel. And it's a column that it might be running this Sunday. I'm not sure. It's, you know, one of my farewell columns. And I'll just give you a spoiler alert. The number one was the 2008 season when they finally broke through after 26 years without making the playoffs. And on the last day of the season, CC Sabathia pitched and they beat the Cubs. And then everybody stayed in the stadium because the Brewers needed to see what the Mets were going to do against the Marlins at home. If the Mets won, they'd tie for the wild card and have a one-game playoff in New York. If the Mets lost, the Brewers were in. And so the Brewers win, and there's a brief celebration on the field. Then everybody just hangs there. The whole crowd stayed at Miller Park. I was stunned at that. And they played the Marlins game up on the big board. And then they lost, and the Brewers, the Marlins beat the Mets. The Mets lost. The Brewers were in, and then the wild celebration started. And it was crazy. It was, you know, it'd been a long time since they had celebrated in Milwaukee, the baseball team, and the first time at Miller Park, what was then Miller Park. And so anybody who was there that day when Sabathia pitched that great game, Braun hit a big two-run homer late. And plus it was the Cubs, you know, Brewers fans always love beating the Cubs. And so, but that, I put that down as my favorite season ever to cover. The historic nature of it was tremendous because I'll be honest with you, Rob, there was a time as the millennium came along where A, I wondered if I would live long enough to see the Brewers make the playoffs, and B, if I would stay employed long enough to see the Brewers make the playoffs. And we finally got to see it. And then, you know, there's been this is, I consider this the golden age of Brewers baseball right now. They've been in the playoffs a lot since then, including the last 4 years.
We're talking to retiring Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers reporter Tom Hodricourt about his 35-plus years covering the team. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the Brewers of the late 80s and 90s, or you try not to remember some of those years? Do you have a favorite moment, a favorite season, memory from County Stadium? How do those years shape your Brewers fandom? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look back at the last 35 years of Brewers baseball with retiring Milwaukee Journal Sentinel beat reporter Tom Hadrecourt. You can join in if you have a question for Tom, a favorite Brewers memory to share, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You were just talking, Tom, about that 2008 game when Milwaukee clinched it with a little help, a playoff spot with a little help later. Let's hear the Brian Anderson broadcast of the double play that ended the game.
On the ground, a chance here. Durham to Hardy to first. In time!
Yes!
The Brewers win!
Yes!
Sabathia, a complete game! And the Brewers beat the Cubs 3-1. Wow. Raise a glass, Milwaukee!
What a game!
Now, Milwaukee has been a contender lately, Tom. The Brewers ending up in the playoffs a lot, still hoping for that World Series. But what's it been like? How has it been different covering a pretty successful team compared to some of those doldrums?
Yeah, it's been, as I said before the break, I consider this, Rob, the golden age of Brewers baseball. They had only once before gone to the playoffs, two straight years in 81 and 82. Until recently, and now they've gone four straight years, and there's good reason to think they'll be a playoff team again this year, assuming the lockout ends, because they have probably what I think is their best pitching staff ever, returning almost intact from last year when they won the division. It's really interesting. For years they were an offensive team. Now last year they became a pitching team, and they figure to be a pitching team again in 2022. And so this is Brewers fans, I know they want to get to that World Series, and that's the goal every year. And they had the pitching to do it last year. Their offense just faltered at the end. But this is, especially in a market like this where it's tough to be consistently good, to be in the playoffs four straight years, it shows you this group of decision makers has been making a lot of smart moves.
I want to talk about covering the Brewers now. You've written a lot of stories, a lot of kinds of stories. Is there a type of story you feel you've been really proud of writing, a particular angle that you've covered for the team over the years?
Well, when you're a beat writer, you get bogged down sometimes in the daily minutiae. You know, baseball is the only sport that plays every day. And so you're just really, the daily coverage can really bog you down at times. So when you're able to dig a little deeper and do some personal side stuff or do some analytical stuff, you know, that's when it gets fun. I did something breaking down Christian Yelich's swing a few years ago, that why did he become such a good power hitter? And then kind of did something almost at the other end of that spectrum recently when he struggled on offense, just what it was that was going wrong for him at the plate. So when you get to dig a little deeper into what we could, you know, what a lot of people call inside baseball, that's when it can be fun, because you oftentimes you're just with the daily news, you're bogged down with that. But one thing I will say though, Rob, is, you know, with all of the modern day analytics and data, you can drown in numbers right now if you let yourself. It's the game being dissected 10 ways to Tuesday now. They have more data and analytical information, statistical information than they've ever had. And so I try to keep what I call the romance of the game still in there a little bit, but there's no question. Sometimes in the last few years, baseball has seemed a little bit like math class. And I don't know about you, but math class was not my favorite class in school.
You've talked to a lot of Brewers players and coaches over the years. Can you name some names on ones that were particularly fun or lively or good interviews for you?
Well, it's just, you know, so many. I'll just say I've never had a relationship with a manager like I have with the current manager, Craig Counsell. And here's why. I've known him since he was a kid. His dad, John, worked in the front office when I started covering the Brewers in the 80s. And Craig would go around, you know, you'd see him in his little league uniform and run around. And I mean, who wouldn't want to come out to the ballpark where his dad worked, you know, when you're a young kid that loves baseball? And in our Journal Sentinel photo book, turning 50, the 50th anniversary book we put out a couple of years ago, it's mostly a photo book, but I wrote the copy for it. There's a photo in there of Craig Counsell in his, as a young teenager in his Little League uniform holding some kind of trophy. And I think he's flanked by like Raleigh Fingers and Deion James, you know, it's kind of a weird photo, but, and so I knew him when he was a kid. Then he played at Whitefish Bay High School, and then he went off to Notre Dame. You kind of lost track of him. And then all of a sudden he pops back up in the majors. And I told him he's a lot like Forrest Gump because he's been in all the right places at the right times. He scored the winning run in the 97 World Series for the Florida Marlins, game 7, was in the winning rally for the Diamondbacks in 2001, game 7 against the Yankees. And then he came to Milwaukee and finished his career as a player. So I covered him as a player as well. And then he became manager. So I've been covering him as a manager. So, if familiarity does breed contempt, he would have a lot of contempt for me, I think. But I don't know if he's happy to see me go. We have a good relationship. And we recently, had coffee together and talked about all the years and where did they all go, for both him and me. But that's a very unique relationship to basically know a manager almost his entire life.
All right. I want to paint you a picture, Tom. You're in Virginia. You're in retirement. You turn on the TV and watch a baseball game, and there's not a deadline hanging over your head. Can you imagine that? What's that going to be like?
I don't know. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I have that all figured out, because I don't. I do think that you can't do something as long as I've done it and not miss it when you stop doing it, right? So I'm sure my head's been spinning lately because we got a lot of things going on with getting ready to, sell a house and move to Virginia and retirement coming next week and just all kinds of things like that. So there's been a lot of details to attend to that have kind of kept my mind off of it. But, when they start playing again this year and I'm not there, it's going to be impossible not to think about that. Under normal times, I'd be in Phoenix right now if there was spring training and if I was not retiring. But I am retiring, and right now there is no spring training because of the lockout. So everything seems a little out of whack right now, Rob. But, give me a call in 2 months and I'll tell you how I'm doing.
In just our last minute, Tom, is there something special about, a pro sports team in a, not one of your larger markets, a Green Bay or a Milwaukee?
Well, I can just tell you, it's been a pleasure to cover the Brewers. They've been so media friendly. I mean, for just from top to bottom, Mark Attanasio, first Doug Melvin, and then David Stearns, Craig Counsell, we just talked about, the media relations staff, Mike Fasalo and Andrew Grumman. I mean, they've just been so much fun and so easy to cover because they've been so media friendly. And I don't think it's exactly like that in every market, but I think, Milwaukee is a little bit of a tight-knit community. There's a lot of people have been here their whole lives, people like Bud Selig and Bob Uecker and just on and on. So it's just been a privilege and a pleasure, and they sure have made my job easy. And I'm very thankful for that and very grateful for that.
Well, Tom, thanks for joining us. Good luck in your last couple columns and enjoy retirement.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate you having me on.
Tom Hodricourt is a Milwaukee Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us today looking back on his 35 years of covering the Brewers as he gets ready for retirement next month. Coming up after the news, what do you think about the idea of 12 weeks of paid family leave for all Wisconsin workers? That's what some Democrats in the state legislature are proposing. We'll hear from one of the bill's sponsors and look at some of the wider issues facing families dealing with the unpaid family leave. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.